Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And, you know, most of us have had the experience at some time in our lives, or maybe more than once, of knowing that information or recommendations or treatment that we're getting just seems wrong or sounds wrong. Like, it just doesn't make sense, or we suspect it might be wrong and maybe it's too drastic or whatever. But often this kind of stuff comes from experts or authority figures in one way or another, and you're afraid to question it or to resist, you know, and yet you think, gee, I'd love to question it, but you suppress that, you know. And often this happens, let's say in the medical system, it'll be a doctor telling you something, you know, you've got this problem and this is what we have to do about it, and that's the end of that. Or maybe a government official, you know, at any level, or, you know, in the school system, for example, or any kind of institution or big system, that's a phenomenon that we've pretty much all run into. And what happens is, in a thing like that, often it happens that later you wish you had spoken up or had followed your instinct because you were right, as it turns out, right? So, but it's maybe too late in some cases to kind of take it back or to do, you know, follow another path. So we're going to have a show today that I'm tentatively calling Wrestling for Your Rights, that's about that kind of thing and the need to advocate for yourself and what you can do. My guest is Pamela Bress, who's a business and commercial attorney in private practice here in East Central Florida. But she's actually, welcome, Pam.
Hi, Court. Nice to meet you.
Thanks for being here. But she's actually not going to be here on the show today in her capacity as an attorney, but really just as a person, you know, an intelligent person like many of our listeners, and somebody who's had this kind of experience and can talk about it from, you know, her own knowledge and experience, as many of you out there could. I suspect many of the people in my audience could be in the studio equally well as a guest, you know, talking about this, because it's just kind of a general life sort of conversation. So, Pam, you've had an experience, I gather, that's along the lines of what we were just talking about in the medical arena. So why don't you go ahead and tell your story, if you don't mind.
Sure. I would say 8 years ago, I had a situation medically where I was told that the symptoms I had were due to a tumor and that I would have to have a hysterectomy. And at that point, I had two children, but my husband and I were discussing having a third child. And once I heard that diagnosis, I thought, well, this is it then. That's it. I guess that's off the table. Can't have a third child. And then as I was driving home, I realized it was depressing to me because that was not really what we wanted. I didn't want it. My husband didn't want it. And so when I got home, we talked about it and decided that not to just accept at face value what we were told, is to research and look into other options, learn as much as we could about the type of tumor, get second, third opinions, whatever was necessary to confirm whether that was the best way to go or that there were other options.
So in that situation, Pam, did you have like a suspicion or an instinct that it really didn't require as drastic a measure as hysterectomy, or did you just hope it didn't and you just wanted to find out all you could about it because it was your life and it would be the end of your reproductive options, as you said, you know? And I mean, did you suspect it might be wrong, or did you just think, it's probably right, but I still want to know everything I can about it? What kind of, which way was it?
Well, I suspected that it was an option, and that given the symptoms that I was having, a lot of bleeding, and it was somewhat serious, that probably that was an option, but I wasn't sure if that was the only option.
Yeah.
And given the advances in medical technology, maybe I needed to look elsewhere and at least investigate other options.
But it was put to you as being the only option at the time, right?
Pretty much, yeah. What we ended up doing after our research was I ended up with a surgeon that specialized in just removing this type of tumor, and I had it removed laparoscopically, which was never even discussed as an option in two meetings with different physicians locally. It wasn't even discussed. So
wow.
What we had done is researched different surgeons and ended up ordering a book over the internet about this type of tumor. It was a fibroid tumor, which is very common among women, and it can cause infertility and all kinds of problems, a lot of bleeding. And the hysterectomy seems to be the common way of treating it, but not necessarily the only, and it all depends. It's a case-by-case basis. You have to look at your situation, your life, your symptoms, and and get second and third opinions.
So it's kind of the simple and quick and dirty answer, but you didn't really accept that.
Exactly.
So what happened after your successful laparoscopic surgery to remove the tumor and you still had ovaries?
Right, exactly. Well, within 8 months after the surgery, and we were also told before we had the surgery by other physicians, oh, you'll never be able to have a child anyway, because once they cut open your uterus, I'm getting graphic here, but and remove this tumor laparoscopically, they basically split it open like a walnut.
Wow.
And carve the tumor out, almost like peel it out like a tangerine using these special tools.
But it's done with very tiny, small tools, but
right.
Still it's quite invasive.
Right. They just basically poke three holes in your abdomen. They blow your stomach up with gas, put the they have a camera type tool, and then they use these other tools. One is to harmonic scalpel to get the tumor out. They open up the uterus, they peel it out almost like a tangerine. It was explained to us, you know, peeling the skin off. Hmm. They peel it out, and then they pull it out piece by piece with another tool, a morcellator, and then they sew you back up. And this
is all, morcellator.
It's called a morcellator.
Cutting it into little bites.
Exactly.
Bite-sized pieces. Yeah.
But we learned all this through research and asking questions. And yeah. Everybody has the right to ask questions. They
yeah.
have the right to inquire, the right to read, the right to look into things, the right to discuss things with other people. You don't have to accept what's told to you at face value.
So you got pregnant and you did have your third child.
Absolutely. Yep, yeah. Natalie. And she's 7 years old.
So your life went on as you had planned it because you intervened with your own ability to investigate. And so I think it has to be said what is obvious should be said, which is that the internet has empowered everyone to a tremendous degree that was never possible 20, 30 years ago. You could have gone to the library and read, you know, 3-year-old textbooks and, you know, and even, you know, medical journals if you could wade through the Lancet or whatever and find it. But it was a big undertaking to do that kind of research. It took a lot of time and it took, scholarly skills to do it, researcher skills. But now on the internet, you can pop in a few words into, you know, Google or whatever, and up comes all you can ever absorb about the topic, and you can follow the threads and you can endlessly find out what you need to know. You can actually check out doctors and, you know, you can really just get a compendious and panoramic view of a situation in, I don't know, many hours of work or even a few hours that was impossible even for professionals 25 years ago, you know, so.
Absolutely. It's at your fingertips. And even if you say, I don't have a computer, you can go to the library and they have computers there. I mean, you can do the research and they'll even help you at the library.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's research assistants at each library. So anybody can look up information for themselves and empower themselves by knowledge.
I was looking up one such website. One that's widely used is Medline Plus, and it's actually from the National Institutes of Health. It's a big website that's put on all aspects of medicine, and you can look up www.nlm, like Nancy Larry Michael, nlm.nih.gov/MedlinePlus. I know you're all out there writing that down, but anyway, nlm.nih.gov, MedlinePlus, or you can just look up MedlinePlus, and it'll pop up, right? So, but that you can search by keyword anything you want to know. And, you know, that site alone has huge amounts of information. And there are dozens of similar sites, you know, and then there are many more specialized things. And then there are blogs with people who suffer from arcane, you know, illnesses or syndromes of various kinds that, you know, and some of which are a little wacky and some of which are very informative. And even specialist doctors and so on get involved in those things. So you can really just find out anything you ever want to know about a topic or more, you know. And I guess it probably, you know, carrying on still the theme of the medical system, it has probably gotten irritating to doctors because now patients come in thinking they know as much as the doctor and they can have an equal one-on-one conversation with them about things that doctors, you know, tend to have. There's a tendency for them to view themselves to be a little arrogant and to view themselves as sort of godlike in their field, and they don't really want to hear much from the patient. And so that has changed the dynamic in the relationship between patients and doctors quite a bit over the last 10 to 15 years the internet has, because people will come in either knowing a lot that's valid about a situation or you know, the illness or whatever it is that they're being treated for. And there may be a mixture of quackery in there, too, or misinformation, too. And the doctor has to then patiently separate those two things and explain, you know, so it's a pain for the medical practice to deal with. But I think on balance, it has empowered patients to a degree that is very positive. And that was clearly an example of that in your situation, right? So.
Yeah. And I recently, my husband and I, trying to be proactive and preventative, I mean, we had colonoscopies, and I was impressed with the physician that we had locally, because he answered all our questions.
Yeah.
And he actually didn't mind them at all. And he was, it seemed to me, more than happy to answer them. So in a way, I think a lot of physicians, when you do come in and you understand what's going on and you ask questions relevant to your research and the procedure that you're having, that the doctors are more than willing to answer your questions. And I think they welcome it.
Well, I think, you know, doctors, like everyone else, run a wide range of patients, and patients with a CE on the end, and niceness and willingness to communicate, you know, and some are gruff and don't want to hear anything from you, and others are very open. But as I said a minute ago, I think that the internet and the extra knowledge that patients has shifted the dynamic overall on average between doctors and patients in the direction of more communication.
I suspect. Oh, definitely. I think you're right.
So these things that we're talking about are true for men as well as women, but I think, would you agree that maybe they're more a factor for women who maybe aren't as inclined by, you know, culture and upbringing and so on to question authority very directly and assertively as men might be? I don't know for sure if that's true, but I suspect that might be true, that what we're talking about here is advocating for your own rights and for intelligent control of your own circumstances, whether it's your body in the case of medicine or whatever, or your property or whatever it might be. And, you know, so I think it may be a little easier for men to do that, to kind of buck authority, than for women. Would you agree?
I think you're right. I think that women tend to not want to be considered being pushy or nasty,
yeah,
by inquiring.
You're
aggressive, and what's your problem?
Yeah.
But if a man was asking, that's okay. But if a woman grills somebody or asks them, it takes on a different connotation. I mean, I just know that from practicing law that, and I was in did a lot of litigation years ago, and I would show up, and it was mostly men, especially in the big commercial litigation, that would be going to calendar call. And at one time I showed up and I was the only female going in, and there were 35 other men. And, if a man was advocating like I was, they were a good lawyer. But as a woman advocating and pushing it and asking all these questions, I had a chip on my shoulder or something like that. So I do believe.
Some kind of feminist, or maybe,
right.
Maybe she, the B word, you know?
Right, exactly. I didn't know if I could use that word, but I've been called that once or twice.
Well, I thought you were going to say that somebody said, so you're the paralegal, where's your attorney?
Oh, well, they did. They said, I'm sorry, ma'am, but only attorneys go in there.
Oh,
and
Lord.
I said, well, see the trial bag and the blue suit and the white shirt, and I need to go in there. That's I belong in there. But, I mean, there's still that. It still goes on.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with attorney Pamela Bress about, that's B-R-E-S-S, Bress, about a topic that's not legal in nature, really, but what I called at the outset, wrestling for your rights. And it's really the need to advocate intelligently and, you know, firmly and fairly for yourself, for your rights, and for solid, good information for you to make decisions on in situations where you're being told what to do, or you're being told what ought to be done to you, you know. And so you have a right, even though those are situations where there's an expert or an authority figure in the position of telling you what you need or what needs to be done or what you should do, you have the right to advocate for yourself and to arm yourself with enough information to be sure in the end and be confident as best as you can tell that you are going to do the right thing, even if it turns out to be what they initially told you to do or something different, you know. And that's an aspect of it, too, that when you're sort of bucking authority, and your first doctor told you very authoritatively you're going to need a hysterectomy, you're afraid to some extent to not do that. You think that if I don't do what that person says, I could end up in a worse situation, right? They're telling, they know, I mean, they do this for a living. They know what they're talking about. They went to college, you know, went to school for many years for this, for med school in that case, and all of that. And he knows more about it than I do. Who am I to say I should do something different? Even if I'm reading lots on the internet that says there are other options, you're still a little nervous about doing something other than what you've been advised to do, because you could be wrong and the consequences could be very extreme. So that's where it's important, I think, to get a second opinion, as you did in that situation with the doctors. And I guess I gather you got second and third and maybe Xth opinions, I don't know, beyond that, right? Did you talk to other professionals?
Yes, I think we talked to a total of three doctors.
Yeah.
And the second one confirmed the research we were doing, that there were other options. But when we started to ask the physician, and we traveled to do that, I mean, we went, you know, a couple hours south to get our second opinion and research somebody that was experienced with this type of tumor. And even then, they didn't have the tools that from our research showed that you needed to. And we started asking, well, do you have this?
You mean the physical equipment?
Right, the physical equipment. And they knew about it, and they thought it was good, but they didn't have the equipment.
You asked him, do you have the morcellator?
Right, yeah, and the harmonic scalpel. And they were surprised we even knew about it.
He said, no, I have the chopper. I have the machete-a-later. Anyway, they were surprised you knew about it. Yeah.
Right, and we were surprised that if you're doing this type of surgery, laparoscopic surgery, that you wouldn't have those particular tools. So, but they knew about them. It's just that they were expensive.
So we thought that's neither here nor there to you. The whole process is going to be expensive anyway.
Exactly. So it's going to cost us a lot to do it, but we want you to use the best equipment. So. And then you start saying, well, we want somebody who believes in buying the best equipment and having the most up-to-date technology and being most up in their practice.
And didn't just buy it yesterday, but has actually used it a few times successfully.
And the person confirmed that they were great tools. They just were too expensive to purchase.
So you didn't hire him.
Right. Considering the surgery was very expensive.
Yeah, that's right.
So they probably could have paid for the equipment with a couple surgeries. So we thought, well, we're not going to go there.
Yeah, that's odd. Yeah, that's like cutting corners, and you don't want them to cut your corner.
Exactly, so, especially with your body.
Well, you know, still on the medical theme, the Florida State website has something that's pretty comprehensive that you can find a lot of information about doctors. For example, you were just talking about specialists in a field, and where you might have a very arcane or specialized syndrome or situation that not many people deal with, you know, in Melbourne or even Orlando or whatever it might be, you can go to Florida's Health. That's Florida with an S on the end, Florida's Health, not an apostrophe, floridashealth.com. And it's a big site, not all that well laid out, but go to their site map on there, and then there's a big kind of a table of contents listing of things, and you can look around and find a lot, for example, on practitioner proficiency, for example, and you can find the level of expertise that specific doctors have in specific procedures, and you can find what's been said about different doctors. There's discipline reports if you want to go to that too, and that can be, you know, depending on your insurance program, you may be restricted to a certain types of practices or certain PPO arenas where, you know, only certain practices are bought into that. And really, it's just like getting your car painted or something. You have every right to find out the level of quality and proficiency of the people who are going to be working inside your body, right? So it's something you really ought to do. And we're talking about, I think I saw somewhere the phrase, better advocacy equals better treatment. And I suspect that in many ways is true, that if you advocate for your situation and for yourself in a reasonable, you know, considered, intelligent, civilized way, you're going to end up getting better treatment. And that's what you did, exactly. You know, so you're a poster child for that that bumper sticker, if I can mix metaphors.
Absolutely. And you always have to be respectful and kind, but you're armed with your knowledge, and you have your knowledge, and you're speaking about it intelligently and calmly, and you want answers. If you have questions, you should get answers. If the answers don't sound right, they probably aren't, or you investigate the answers to confirm whether your thoughts about the accuracy of the responses is right. I mean, you said something earlier about insurance, and with that same situation, I had to battle my insurance. Before I had the surgery, I had to get hormone shots to shrink the tumor before it could be removed laparoscopically, and each shot was $1,500.
Is that right?
Right, and wow. I had to have four of them, and my insurance at the time did not have that particular one on the approved list. They had a different one.
A
different drug, which had a host of side effects, and the doctor that was going to do the surgery refused to prescribe that one because he said the side effects are horrible. And it was Lupron, I think, at the time, and there's all kinds of people that suffer from problems with that, and he wanted a different one. And this insurance company said, no, it's not on our approved list. So I had to fight with them. Had to take it all the way up on appeal. But I looked it up. I researched the drug. I had information from the doctor. And they eventually approved it. But I was staring at, having to pay for that myself,
yeah.
Which would have been prohibitive on top of the surgery, out of network. I mean, so again, I said, no, that's not right. And you're not up on the latest research. You need to look at this, and this. And thank you for my doctor was very helpful with the information and my research and my husband's research. We were able to combat the insurance company and fight them on that issue. And with that information, they changed, they approved it and paid for the shots.
So that's another kind of thing, as I said at the outset, sometimes you're talking to an expert, in that case it was the doctor, and sometimes you're dealing with an institution or a system or a bureaucracy, whether it could be a government or in this case an insurance company. And, as you know from that experience and many others, and all of our listeners know too, you can go through layer after layer of, functionaries or people who just answer the phone and give rote answers, and take information down and put it in their computer, and they're not empowered to make decisions at all. And in the end, you may just think, oh, it's so frustrating. I'm just going through, wall after wall after wall and not getting anywhere. And at the same time, you do get what you pay for. And if you've got a certain insurance policy, it's a contract, and you're getting the message from them of, I'm sorry, your insurance does not allow for that drug, period. That's the end of story, And you tend to think, well, I guess maybe that's right. And it's unreasonable of me to expect them to pay for something that is not in my contract with them. But if you push it well enough, armed with enough information, very often you can get a different answer, and that's what you did. But you have to be very persistent, and you have to kind of know how to work systems and talk to people. It's, it takes skill and talent to do that, and maybe more in that case than it would in an average case, but it can be done, right? So.
Oh, absolutely, and persistence is definitely the key. I think when I was doing that research on the insurance company, I read somewhere in an article or in other research that something like 70%, if I recall it right, 70 to 80% of the people just accept their insurance denials at face value.
Sure.
I guess that's it. And, you need to be persistent, but you also need to have all your facts and your research and be prepared to go to bat. You got to arm yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of like trying to sell a novel. You're going to get a lot of rejection slips before you finally get an acceptance. And excuse me, you've got to, just be not willing to give up and not willing to be depressed because you keep being told no. You just have to keep going, calling again and getting a different person and trying to get one level up and all of that. We're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're here today with Pamela Bress, an attorney, and we're talking about basically advocating for yourself against any system or authority figure, anything that's arrayed against you that's telling you something that you need to do or that should be done that you don't agree with, and how hard that can be, and how it takes persistence and knowledge and research and education to do it, but you can succeed in getting what you think, a different answer, basically, often. If the answer you want is the right one, you can get a different answer. An example, again, in the medical arena is, this is surprising, that I guess the general thing is that heart disease and heart attacks have often traditionally been considered problems for men, right? With their fast, tougher, stressful careers and so on, and that men have been seen as more prone to heart attacks, particularly overweight men. And there's the kind of the Hollywood image of you know, the fat guy clutching his chest and falling to the floor, you know, that's sort of the heart attack and the left arm hurts. And so heart disease in women has been a lower priority for the medical system traditionally until recently, when kind of data has come out and just, I guess, experience has shown the medical system that the incidence of heart disease in women, unfortunately, is increasing and has become almost that of men for various reasons. And actually, heart disease now is the leading killer of American women, which is surprising to me to read. And that it's actually the second, apart from accidents, the second most common medical cause of death in women is breast cancer. And heart disease outpaces that by a factor of five or six, five to six times as many women die of heart disease as they do of breast cancer, depending on which numbers you read or whatever. But that's a huge gap and a big factor. And the other thing is that the symptoms of a heart attack, let's say, in women are often more subtle. They're milder, and they're not as dramatic and obvious as they tend to be in men. And, for example, about a third of all women who have heart attacks have no chest pain, and 71% of all of the women who end up with heart attacks report flu-like symptoms for 2 to 4 weeks before that, including vomiting and things like that. So they get diagnoses like, well, you've got stomach flu, or you have, you know, depending on the kind of discomfort they have, you have acid reflux, or you're just stressed out, or you need to get more sleep, and things like that. So they've been traditionally often dismissed by the medical system as not having heart attacks, and so until suddenly they go into the emergency room and they're under having a full blown heart attack. And even then, you know, you can read stories about women going in having a heart attack, and the nurse just tells them, go sit down over there. We'll call you when we're ready. And, you know, here, take this clipboard and fill out these forms. Whereas a man would be immediately thrown on the gurney and they've got an IV in him within 30 seconds or whatever. And so that's starting to change, but it hasn't changed as much yet. And, partly because women themselves don't think immediately that they're having a heart attack. Whereas a man who has sudden severe chest pain thinks, oh, I'm having a heart attack. He gets to the emergency room and he announces loudly, I'm having a heart attack, you know. And only about 40% of women who have a heart attack actually think initially that it's a heart attack. So it's kind of a combination problem there, but women need to be more aware that symptoms like that, whether chest pain or even flu-like symptoms, could potentially be heart-related. And they certainly need to say, if they go to the emergency room for those things, I could possibly be having a heart attack. Could you check me for that too, you know? And by the same token, then they need to be able to advocate to doctors if they start having, you know, angina-type chest pains. As we're talking about here in this show of advocating for yourself and for your rights, they need to start advocating with their doctor that, could you check me for heart symptoms? Because I think I might be having that. So, we've just got about 30 seconds left or so, Pam, but I want to thank you for being on. Do you have anything else you'd like to say kind of in this? I've been chatting along here by myself for the last minute or two. Anything you want to say about this to kind of wrap it up?
Well, I'm just to follow up on your thing about the heart attacks in women. I mean, women have stress more so than men realize, and stress is a contributor to heart attacks. So just be wary. You should deserve some immediate treatment.
That's for sure. Thanks, Pam, for being on with us. And thank you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in next Sunday, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.